Thank you so much, Robin and Delita, for that beautiful prelude. Good morning, everyone. Good morning. Welcome to Prairie Unitarian Universalist Society. I am Ann Lundeen, and I'm the current vice president of the society. Prairie aspires to be both an open-hearted and an open-minded congregation. We welcome people of every ethnic and religious background, whatever your color, sexual orientation, or family structure. We welcome you no matter what your age or your abilities or inabilities. Toward the end of the service, we invite visitors, guests, and returning friends to introduce yourself so that we may get to know you better. On Sunday mornings, we provide a rich array of services. They are presented either by a Prairie member, a member of the wider community, or by our minister, Ralph Tyczynski. Today, we will have a panel of three of our members in a program called This I Believe, part of a series. Our opening words today are attributed to Kalidasia. Look to this day, for it is life, the very life of life. In its brief course lie all the verities and realities of your existence, the bliss of growth, the glory of action, the splendor of beauty. For yesterday is only a vision, but today, well lived, makes every yesterday a dream of happiness and every tomorrow a vision of hope. Look well to this day. We will begin with hymn 91, Mother of All. Lighting reading will be done by Bob Cape, which will be followed by a time of silent meditation. And we invite you today to consider during that meditation some of your gratitudes.
We come together this morning to remind one another to rest for a moment on the forming edge of our lives, to resist the headlong tumble into the next moment until we claim for ourselves awareness and gratitude. Take the time to look into one another's faces and see their communion, the reflection of our own eyes. This house of laughter and silence, memory and hope, is hallowed by our presence together. As a caring community, the next we are doing is joys and concerns.
Well, I'm off tomorrow to visit my daughter in Alaska. And we've had several conversations on the phone. Two times ago, she said, well, it's snowing, but don't bring your boots. And I talked to her yesterday, and she said, I think maybe you better bring your boots.
Oh, no.
We were supposed to get an inch, and there's eight.
Oh, no.
We're going to Talkeetna on Tuesday for lunch. They get 22. But, she said, it will melt. I said, dear, 22 inches is not going to melt in 3 days. She said, but it's light a long time here.
Yeah, I was going to say something else, which was our house is afloat.
Oh, no.
It's afloat on a sea of subterranean water, and oh. It was quite, I almost thought the outside drain or the pipes outside had broken because, you know, this flow of water into our basement. It's no big tragedy for what we had stored down there. Wasn't all that valuable for the most part. But I did succeed in getting a garage full of stuff out of the basement and into the garage. And Marilyn and I are going to deal with that later today. It may prompt us to do a garage sale this spring, though. And certainly we're going to get rid of some stuff. So perhaps out of a little bit of tragedy is going to come some profit.
That's the spirit.
It's been a rather eventful week at our house also. Amy's not here because she's driven Charlie up to Mackinac Island where he's starting his job for the summer.
Wow.
And then she's driving on to Pittsburgh where my daughter is. I'll be joining them with my other daughter for Abby's graduation from grad school this coming Saturday.
Wow.
So I'll be here next week.
That's great.
She just finished museum studies, so if anybody knows a good museum job, she'd be very interested.
Right.
That is the next step.
Great.
Last Sunday, we were in Racine and not able to be here because we were celebrating Margaret's birthday. I think I better not say which one. And the two Sundays before that, we were driving to and from Sedona, Arizona. We enjoyed the 3 days drive, 1,700 miles each way. We enjoyed the 3 days drive a lot, going and coming. Sedona, which is up in the mountains and north of Phoenix, is known for mystical qualities and vortexes. My observation is that those mystical experiences are probably primarily available to those who are receptive, and I'm not among that number. The scenery is tremendous, the climate is excellent, the company and the food were good.
I haven't been upstairs here in a few weeks. I'm happy to be back. I guess it's 3 weeks ago, my sister Pat got married for the second time to her longtime companion, Dick Latner, in a Jewish ceremony in Touro Synagogue, rather, in New Orleans, and that was very interesting. And they got married under the chuppah, and our family was apparently the only non-Jews there, which was which was very interesting when everybody else knew how to sing all the prayers and we didn't. So that was nice. I'm glad I got to go down for that. And then the last 2 weeks I've been with the high school RE class, who are sitting back here and kind of scattered in the rows, and they're as part of our neighboring face world religions course, we've been studying Catholicism. So we had a discussion 2 weeks ago, and last week we went to a mass at St. Thomas Aquinas Church over near Memorial High School, which was very interesting because it was they had the choir from the diocesan Hispanic choir came, and so a lot of the mass was sung, and some of it was in Spanish, so it was very different than prayer.
Well, this last week, as many of you know, has been a very interesting week for Rose and me. She had surgery a week ago, last Friday morning. Had to be at the hospital something like, 5 o'clock in the morning. And so it's been kind of a roller coaster ever since. But she is better. I went to the simulcast of Daughter of the Regiment yesterday at the movies with Ruth and Rosemary, and we had a great time. She's at home resting today. She probably was capable of coming, but she preferred to rest. But we want to thank everybody here for all the wonderful attention that they gave her, and also our other friends.
Well, I've been the treasurer for Prairie now for the last year, and it was kind of driven home to me how much I've kind of taken on this job. When I was sitting in a wedding yesterday at a Presbyterian church in Wanakee, and I was kind of idly leafing through their brochures and whatnot, and their brochure kind of telling what their church does throughout the year. One of the things that they do at Christmas time is a live nativity, where they have people actually sitting outside. But they also have live animals, including camels. And my first thought was, wow, I wonder what their insurance is like.
It's nice there's humor around still. I went to see my poor sister. They're now calling it Alzheimer's. Last summer, I went to see her, and she was very angry and depressed for good reason. And she said to me, I wish I had an axe to chop some wood. This time when I visited her, her gaze was on the ground. She can barely speak, and she's starving herself. She knows how to get out fast. Can't get out any other way.
Today, we have the third in a series that I've been organizing called This I Believe. Some of you may have heard that phrase before. It actually comes from a radio series that Edward R. Murrow started decades ago. And recently, NPR has revitalized the series and actually come out with a book, too. This morning, I heard one on the radio. And so today we have three of our members who will share some of their beliefs. We have Judy Skog and Bob Cape and Rosemary Lester.
And I want to let you know that this is highly unrehearsed. We have not coordinated these. The only thing we agreed on is to all show up today. And that Judy got to go last. Well, I was not privileged to be here at the last This I Believe, but I really enjoyed the first one. And one of the things that people started with is, where did you come from? So I'll start there, too. I was raised in a Presbyterian church in North Shore, Chicago. It was fairly liberal. There was no Bible thumping or hellfire and damnation. But it was quite clear that the minister, at least, felt that if you were a good Christian, you had to believe the Bible as a matter of faith. And this I found a little odd, and was kind of rebelling against it. And I think largely because of the rest of the world. I was also raised in public schools of North Shore Chicago, and I was very enamored of science. And the teachers there, I think, were quite smart. And they left some underlying themes that I found to be quite useful. They said to think for yourself, to look for evidence for things, not to just accept what people thought, and to always keep in your mind that you may be wrong, because that's one of the hallmarks of a good scientist. And of course, when I hear you may be wrong, and you hear the minister say, you've got to believe this, well, there's a conflict there. And in my youth, I became certain, as youths are, that I kind of turned my back on religion for quite a long time. I didn't go to church for many, many years. Went to a Quaker college. Quakers don't say a whole lot. But the professors there were often quite Quakers, and they're quite devout and quite good scientists, and they seem to see no big conflict there. At any rate, as I've gone through my years, I've looked at human nature. That's my job. I'm a doctor. And found that scientific thought explains a lot of human behavior. Certainly, one of the hallmarks of Darwinism is we try to get ahead by getting food and shelter and reproducing. And certainly when people go to work, they're looking for those things. It's very easy to understand. A second reason that people behave the way they do, or animals behave the way they do, is called sexual selection. This is mating behaviors, things that don't directly get us more food or better shelter, but seem to be important for the reproduction of the species. For instance, it does the peacock no good to have a big, huge tail. Doesn't get him more food, doesn't make him more inconspicuous, but it seems to be necessary for the mating. So they kind of have evolved that way. And we can certainly see human mating rituals that same way. At the same time, a lot of human behavior can be not particularly admirable. You see a lot of avarice, greed, a lot of behavior that can be explained by the seven deadly sins, in other words. But then you're also left with human behavior that can't be explained by any of the above. And I'm thinking about things like courage, about compassion, about charity. They offer no survival advantage. You don't have any more kids that way. You don't get a better house. But it speaks to something deep within our heart. That is a universal theme. If you look around human societies, you'd be hard-pressed to find one with no belief in God. If you look at the way people behave, it's a really rare person who doesn't feel for others. The evidence of behavior and feelings within humans that can't be explained by what Darwinian behavior is all around us. I think for the most part, it is a universal condition for the humans. And my belief is that there was no God that created the universe. I think it happened through natural forces. But I think sometime in human evolution, and I'm not sure when, something sparked inside the human condition that brought God into existence. And I think God lives within all of us. I think that it's responsible for our courage, our compassion, our charity, and our sense of right and wrong. And I also believe that that is a prime ingredient in what's made humans successful species. We all remember a couple years ago, Christmas time, there was a huge tsunami that wrecked the Indian Ocean. And there was some talk among fundamentalist preachers about how this was the work of God. But did we notice that right after that, there was a second tsunami? Tsunamis have two phases, an in phase and an out phase. And the first thing that happened is there was no news that came out of Aceh province. Telephones, radios, all communication cut off. Then we heard news of devastation, destruction. And then things started flowing the other way. Prayers, compassion, charity, relief. It flowed in from all over the earth. It lasted for weeks, slowly building momentum, then ebbing. And so when people ask if God can cause a tsunami, I'd say probably yes.
Last 2 weeks ago, our topic was seeking truth and living with doubt, and that could be the end of my talk, because, but that wouldn't be quite fair. I grew up in Berlin, Germany, a very sheltered and much loved only child. None of the members of my small family were churchgoers, nor were they religion bashers or atheists. When I was about 5 or 6, my mother sent me to a Sunday school. I think it was a private Sunday school, and that was really fun. Lots of nice stories about Jesus, who seemed a very nice person, gentle, helpful, fair, and just. And his dad, the God, did expect you to be truthful and kind to others. He also expected you to know the Lord's Prayer and the Ten Commandments. That seemed fair enough, but a little hard to understand. There wasn't much talk about the Holy Ghost and heaven and hell, and what was said seemed vague, and I didn't take it seriously, and neither did my parents when I asked them about it. But the belief I took with me from that school was that lying, cheating, stealing, and cruelty to man and beast were really low down bad and would bring consequences of one kind or another. There was never any mention of hell and damnation, but consequences, and I still believe in that. Made sense to me then, and it does now. Being good also meant that you were your brother's keeper. I didn't quite understand that at age 5 or 6. And you should forgive even the most horrible, mean things, just like Jesus' dad forgave you. That was hard to understand, and I confess sometimes it's hard to understand for me now. At 15, my mother sent me to confirmation class. I lucked out again. My pastor was a wonderful, wise man with whom you could discuss everything, and he was not a Nazi. I was his favorite student because I always knew the right answers, even though he knew that I didn't believe them myself. He sometimes called me a doubting Thomas. And I finally told him that I could not be confirmed because it would be a lie. He gave me a hug and then left that decision totally up to me. I loved that man. But then my unchurched family swooped down on me. The great fest had all been planned, the people invited, the food and flowers chosen, and my mom, who never went to church, was so sad. They won. And I walked down the aisle in church, tears literally streaming down my face. I was so ashamed. My father had given me a book for my confirmation with an inscription from the New Testament. In German it reads, "Seid klug wie die Schlangen, aber ohne falsch wie die Tauben." In English, that is, "Be ye therefore wise as the serpent, but without falsehood as the dove." My mom and the aunts didn't much care for it, and at 16 I didn't quite understand, but I knew there was something important speaking to me, and in time I learned what it really meant and what it asks of me as a decent human being. That I still believe. "Be ye therefore wise as the serpent, and without falsehood as the dove." Fast forward now to the U.S., marriage, 2 kids, and Sunday school, being sucked into, no, that's not quite fair, I wasn't sucked into, I adapted to the American way of church as a pleasant Sunday social event in hat and heels. This was the 50s, remember? Going through a painful divorce, my dear Lutheran neighbor, a friend still today, took me to church with her, and thanks to another world-wise and stimulating pastor, that helped a lot. So I kept passing around half-heartedly with Lutheranism. My kids were confirmed, until we moved to Sioux Falls, South Dakota, where I studied for my BA at night, at a Lutheran college that required 2 semesters of theology. I took religion in America and found Unitarianism. Bingo! Spiritual fresh air, no dogma, no Holy Ghost. Instead, a deep and abiding for life in capital letters, in all its glory and messiness. And just one life is all we humans really have, isn't it? Respect and love for life, that was the deciding factor. For me, who as a child and preteen had seen, mediated by my parents, the total disrespect of human life and glorification of death under the Nazi regime, and who then, as a teen, survived 4 years of nightly, then day and nightly terror bombing and ultimately the horror of the Soviet army. It was respect for life and a fierce determination to survive that became the guiding principles of my existence. And in that context, I would like to end my 5, maybe 6 minutes now, by quoting William James, psychologist, philosopher, and founder of pragmatism, that perhaps most American of all philosophies. The quote, "The part of wisdom as well as of courage is to believe what is in the line of your needs, for only by such belief is the need fulfilled. You make one or the other of two possible universes true by your trust or mistrust, both universes having only been maybes, doubts, before you contributed your act." And this, I believe.
Well, you're going to get the one sentence version of how I got here. I was raised in confirmed Presbyterian, discovered feminism, got pissed at God, flirted with paganism, came to believe in the universe, and throughout it all I have looked to nature for healing and inspiration. My spirituality has an internal component and an external component. Noticing messages from nature would be part of my internal practice. Social action along UU principles is part of my external spiritual practice. I believe in the inherent worth and dignity of all people and in the interdependent web of all existence. I also believe in equity and compassion in human relations. I believe that there are no coincidences, but I also believe that we have free will, so, you know, we can muck around with the no coincidences part. If I am grounded and in tune with the universe, good things can happen. If I am ungrounded or choose to ignore messages from the universe, bad things sometimes happen. I am a feeling person, and my spirituality involves things that touch my heart. I work hard to have an open heart. I believe in leaving the world a better place for the next generation. You guys have all heard this, but you're going to hear it again. My favorite quote is by Edward Everett Hale. "I am only one, but still I am one. I cannot do everything, but still I can do something. And because I cannot do everything, I will not refuse to do the something that I can do." I believe that I am an energy being and that when I die, my energy or my soul will continue. I believe that I can be affected by energy or vibration and that I can have an effect on others through my energy field. If I am ungrounded, you may perceive me as being a little jarring, especially if I'm caffeinated. If I am angry, you will feel it in my energy field. If I am grounded and at peace with myself, you will perceive me quite differently. Okay, now this is the doing part here. So I'm a kinesthetic learner, and I'm going to demonstrate in a direct way. I would like to demonstrate in a direct way the effect that energy can have on you. So what I'd like you to do is to sit comfortably, close your eyes, and feel your body. Just take a minute to do a scan. In a moment, I'm going to walk around the room with some tuning forks, and I would like you to keep your eyes closed and feel how the vibrational energy of the tuning forks affects your body. And keeping your eyes closed, if you wish, I'm going to make a second pass after the tuning forks with the singing bowl. And I just want you to feel the difference between the two energy fields.
We have some time, and I invite Rosemary and Bob and Judy to share some observations or ask questions of each other, and then we'll open it up to the group.
Well, that was fascinating. When I heard the tuning forks, it's kind of like the first initial was very unpleasant. I felt it in my chest and it kind of spread out. But the singing bowl didn't do that. I felt it in my fingers like a vibration that was almost continuous.
That's why I did it that way.
Well, I'm a musician, and tuning forks and things like that are not that mystical to me. And so, okay, I thought it was the tuning fork and the singing bowl, and that was it. So, sorry about that. No, it didn't do anything to my body. It just did something to my ears, which was not unusual. So, oh, could you really? Oh, yeah. Oh, really? Oh, amazing.
Uh-huh. And the bowl can do that.
Oh. Okay. Yeah, I think the tuning form has a little sharper level of sound. It is higher. Yeah. So, but it's interesting. My question to you is that how does this specifically fit into your belief system? Can you... You were saying in the beginning you could give us a very short version. Now, can you just make it very short? I believe, and then relate it to this, to your interest in this.
Well, for starters, I picked that particular set of tuning forks because it's the interval of the fifth, and it tends to be quite jarring, and it can open you up to new possibilities, which is what the singing bowl was for, was to quiet things down again. I don't always use tuning forks. I have some protocols that I can use, but they're kind of lengthy. And you know how a lot of good intentions are. They tend to fall by the wayside after a while. The tuning forks, the singing bowl, is all part of the vibrational energy being part. That's my those are my internal practices. And then the external practices are what I do out in the world. I don't know, does that answer your question? Not really.
Well, yeah, it does in a way.
So. My beliefs evolved, you know, and this is where I am at this moment in time.
Yeah. You believe that we are sort of all influenced and surrounded by these invisible energy flows? Okay.
You know, when you get around noisy environments like vibrations and artificial noises like that, it drives people crazy sometimes. It can really set you off.
I have a question to you, and I can't quote what it was now, but when you spoke about human nature, you said something very positive. I think it had to do with that it was in human nature to be compassionate to others. Can you say that again, and then I can maybe ask my question?
Well, there's an inherent question, are people inherently good or bad? And certainly we have both tendencies, but almost everybody has a strong sense of right and wrong. They feel glowing when they do something generous for others. That's a very, very common human condition. And very few people don't know right from wrong, don't try to act right, at least to some degree. Of course, the consequences of acting wrong, like greed and avarice, get you more things, so there's always that drive also. The human mind is very complex. It can't be explained very simply.
So to that, I would just have to confess that I'm not quite as optimistic as you are, because I don't quite believe that humans are inherently good. I think human beings, number one, are inherently nothing, first of all, at birth, and then they are blessed or not blessed by those things that can be genetically inherited. There are a few things, like a certain ability in visual, in arts or musicality and so forth. But much of the ideas of right and wrong really are learned. And when we talk about the human condition, all humans are inherently good, we're really talking about our Western society and our privileged societies that learn about this thing. And there's a vast world out there that we have no ideas about, who are not most of them can't even read, and who are not privileged to read and learn to debate and make judgments. And I think sometimes we just take our small civilized, or I shouldn't even say civilized, our small privileged Western world as the whole world, and we know it isn't. This is just my typically German negative attitude, I guess. Everybody says the Germans always find a negative thing, and that there's some truth to that. But anyway, I would call it more realism or skepticism.
Well, I'm not widely traveled. I never really spent much time in the Third World, but I would say the vast majority of people in this world have inherent sense of right and wrong and doing the right thing. I think we have a few examples that seem to pervade all cultures of sociopaths who really don't seem to understand. And oftentimes these people are raised side by side with their siblings who do just fine. My feeling is it's probably some kind of genetic malfunction in those people.
Are there some responses and questions from others?
Actually, scientifically, they've shown altruism in the great apes and chimpanzees and stuff. So apparently it is genetic.
Yeah, and there are also reports of whales, the great whales, behaving in compassionate manners. There are numerous reports of elephants leafing through the bones of their dead comrades and almost reverent looking. So it's not strictly the people.
Into that, this is interesting because this even goes to goes back to William James. Not it doesn't go back to him, but he mentions these. He has these quotes, and pragmatism says that you believe what is in the line of your needs to believe, and these all altruistic tendencies in different societies or in animal society fulfill a need, and that is the need of the group to be peaceful and not kill each other. And there is a debate, of course, now going on among philosophers. Is this what we think of as altruism, or is it really a very well functioning tendency to do the things that keep us alive? If you want to call this altruism, fine. But there's also, I haven't traveled in the Third World much either, but there's also the fact that in other societies and other religion, good and bad are not the same things. You know, every religion has its own specific analysis or definition of what is right and wrong, what is good and bad. So I'm not quite that sure, that certain that every society has the same kind of feeling for good and bad. In fact, we know that some have very different ones.
But I think they're trying to do good.
Okay. I think that the general nature of things is for good to prevail, because sort of like Rosemarie said, it's better for all of our beings if things are peaceable and we watch out for each other. On the other hand, I believe altruism also exists, and as Barb was saying, there was that example of the monkey, the mother monkey, who saw a child fall over the rail at a zoo and went and picked up the child and took it to the keeper, knowing the child was not safe there and needed help, and needed human help. That's amazing to me, but I think altruism is very much alive, and that we all learn from that, as well as learning the bad things from bad people.
With regard to Judy's different sound things, which I could have heard a lot more examples of, I thought it was very interesting. The mystics and the physicists come together when in music. They may not agree as to what's going on, but there is what is called the diabolus in musica, which some of you may know about. It is a particular interval that drives singers crazy. I have had music students just stop in their tracks and say, oh, I made a mistake. No, you didn't make a mistake. Those combinations of intervals are sending out conflicting sound waves that just grate your teeth. And there are other combinations of intervals that are calming. And the there is a book this thick on piano tuning. historical piano tuning that gets into both, I think, the physics and the mysticism. And Brahms, the composer of a piece that the choir is working on right now, knew it well, and the pianos were tuned very differently from what our piano is tuned today. And the composers of those eras, clear up until the 1940s, knew what keys to shift into if they either wanted to mellow you out, make you angry, or grate your teeth.
Well, I wanted to comment on Judy's demonstration, too. When she went around with a tuning fork, first of all, I'm a little familiar with tuning, not very, but, you know, I've heard tuning forks, but I never heard one that was that harsh.
It's two.
Okay.
It's the interval of a fifth. Yeah.
So you're going to demonstrate again to show us?
Well, that's true, yeah. No, it was two that I hit together.
You want to do it again? Okay, the way that struck me was like church bells, but it was very, very harsh. And
partly that's because I hit them together.
Yeah.
But I did that.
But I'm just saying the sound was such that it was very harsh and was very grating to me. Grating on my body, I guess. But the... And then that reminded me of two things that, you know, are kinetic as well. And one is like playing the guitar and hearing, you know, like arpeggios, very calming. And like doing rhythmic gardening work, like hoeing the garden, very calming as well. So it can be part of a spiritual practice, I guess.
Part of the thing with the metal bowl is that it's made from a number of metals. And I'm not going to go into this in any detail, but what it does is it sets off overtones. And it's the overtone series that's the calming part. Overtones meaning it's not just a single vibration, it's a series of vibrations.
I'd like to comment on the panel's various comments about doing right or wrong. The question is, what is right and what is wrong? And I had a very, very strange experience last week. Rose had to go to the emergency room at the hospital during the week, and I spent most of the night there. And picked up a copy of New Yorker magazine, and in that latest New Yorker, there's a wonderful, wonderful article, and I'm having a senior moment. I can't remember the name of the author, but everybody knows the man who wrote Collapse, the book, right?
Jared Diamond.
Okay. He was an anthropologist, and he tells a story, which I think everybody should read. I'm going to get a copy of that and read it carefully. But I sort of skimmed it while I was there, you know, half awake, 3 o'clock in the morning. And it's a story, a personal story about, I think it was Borneo where he was working. And a man that he worked with helped him in his research work. He was a very, very fine man, very helpful with him. But also, he was part of the local culture in local tribes and clans in which the tradition is revenge killings for anything that's done wrong to a relative of yours has to be revenged by generally killing. In this particular case, he saw to it that the killing was carried out, except it wasn't complete. The man was shot in the back with an arrow through the spine and ended up in a wheelchair or not able to walk the rest of his life. And that was fine. Everybody was very happy about that. The point that Garrett Diamond made is that this is the norm for human societies, or was until a few hundred years ago, all over the world. And these people who live in those societies, and we still see those now. You know, a lot of what we see in the Middle East and the Near East going on is a symptom of those that old tradition, very ancient traditions. What was I going to say? Here's the summary. Anyway, this is normal for society, and it's to some extent we're living now in our modern societies, what we call civilized societies, as a kind of a controlled. We've learned to control this basic urge for revenge.
So it sounds like you're saying that people's impulse towards good, or their understanding of good and evil, is has external definitions.
I think you should read that article. I'm going to get a copy of it.
Could I just add to that? It's not a matter of 200 years ago. When I lived in Frankfurt, Germany, Germany had the largest percentage of immigrants from Turkey, and the honor killings of Turkish society is a deeply rooted tradition, and there were so many cases, and the Germans didn't know what to do with this anymore, because obviously this sort of thing is directed against young women who get together with any non-Turkish or non-Islamic foreigners, and the killings were really demonstrably a large percentage. So it's a very real thing still in many societies. And what is good and bad about that now, and the reasons for killing all these young women and so forth, and it's a lot of them, is considered good by that society, where it is considered horrendous by another society. So there is this relativity, unfortunately, we have to admit.
The amazing thing is the same individuals who carry out these revenge killings are very fine people in other contexts of their. I mean, they do all the things that we think are good.
A couple of months ago, when I was on the panel, I addressed the issue of comfort, spiritual comfort, and I would be interested if any of the three of you wanted to share with us when someone dies, when you're in some kind of pain, etc., do you seek spiritual comfort, and where do you seek that?
Well, at my age, you lose a lot of people, and when I was very young, I lost a lot of people, and during the war, and right after the war, even. And I still grieve about the people who were very close and dear to me that I lost because of the war and the Nazi regime and so forth. And the way I seek comfort now is to surround myself with pictures of them, and I have a tendency to save letters and notes. You can call me a rat pack rat, but that's what it is. And now when people die, you know, I have a lot of friends who are contemporaries who also lose people. So the friendships of people and the memorials that we hold, I remember the one for my very dear friend Pat Cartley, where I was privileged to, talk about her. So it's other people that provide comfort, the community, the prairie community, and sometimes I withdraw and listen to good music or something like that. But I must say, the people whom I lost at an unreasonably young age, my age and their age, I still commemorate with these endless boxes of pictures and so forth.
Well, I guess the short answer to where I go for solace is a walk in the woods. You know, as a doctor, I've come to realize a long time ago that none of us have any guarantees we're even going to live through the day. So I think that the key is to live each day the way you want to. If you find yourself doing things you don't want to do, start doing it differently right now. There's no time to lose.
In my counseling group, meaning I went to counseling, one of the members of our group, I was privileged to go through her walk with cancer, and it was a great privilege to me to be witness to that, because she was a nun and she worked really hard at dealing with it, and she was in a state of grace most of the time. It was hard work, I know. So I look at death. Death is not the end. That's what I said about being an energy being. Her physical body is buried in the ground somewhere, I don't know. But her energy being is still out there. Don't ask me about incarnation. I'm not going there because I have no idea. But that gives me a lot of solace. Now, when my parents died, I worked really hard as they were failing at saying goodbye, at being with them and saying goodbye as they were failing. And so it wasn't so difficult when they did actually die. And otherwise, for bad things, most of the time I just need to deal with my feelings of anger around whatever the bad thing was. And if I deal with my feelings of anger, then I've made peace with whatever it is and can go on.
Sorry to keep coming back to this same topic, but I wanted to make a couple points on this discussion of altruism. I guess it seems to me that altruism is sort of innate in the human condition, but that circumstances don't always allow it to flourish. Like, as people grow up in the society that they're surrounded by, just sort of the culture and their circumstances don't always allow them to bring that to the front. I mean, you know, it's simple for someone like Bill Gates, who has billions of dollars, to be a philanthropist and be altruistic and give his money away to other people. It's not always as easy for people who aren't in those circumstances, but yet it's still amazing that people who have almost nothing still oftentimes give it away to other people. And then the other point I wanted to make is regarding whether all the sort of tendency toward altruism was just sort of a technique to help the human species survive, or whether it was something more. And I would say that it really doesn't matter, as long as that instinct is there to help us and to help human society improve. Does it really matter where it came from?
I saw a well done research article that showed that if you look at giving the percentage of your income, poor people give a higher percentage of their income than richer people do.
Thank you so much. Thank you, Judy and Bob and Rosie. I wanted to mention that our next This I Believe will be August 10th, when Dirk Herrholman, Heidi Hughes, and Robin Proud will be sharing with us. I'm already starting to think toward the fall. The series goes on as long as there are willing volunteers. So if you would be interested and in participating, please let me know. Prairie, as a caring community, runs on love, but also on money, and we welcome your contributions as we listen to some beautiful music, Adagio for Two Clarinets by C.P.E. Bach, by our two artists.
Thank you.
Thank you so much. Now is the time for us to welcome guests and visitors. If you are here for the first or second time or haven't attended for a while, we invite you to introduce yourself and say what brought you here. Please take the time to read the announcements on the order of service. Are there any additional brief prairie announcements?
There will be no meditation this morning as originally scheduled because of the strategic planning session review.
I just want to let everyone know that our young people have been downstairs working on their Service Sunday project, and what they've been doing is baking chocolate chip cookies, sugar cookies, and cinnamon buns to raise money for the children in Nepal. Now, some of you might know that Isha, our child care provider, is from Nepal. She came here when she was 11 with her family, and she'll be going back this summer to work with the children. She's working with an organization that's going to help raise money for the children so they can go back to school and have enough money for books and pens, paper, that kind of stuff. So the children will be selling that, along with some gourd birdhouses that some of you have seen in the fall. You might have bought some before. So they're going to be raising that money, and then that will all go towards the children there. So hope you guys can check it out. There's some good stuff.
Our final hymn is 1003, Where Do We Come From? It's from Singing the Journey.
Okay, and this is a round, and the choir's going to help you learn it and sing it. And you'll notice that each line repeats itself, which is sort of unusual for a round. Choir's getting in position. So first of all, if everybody is standing, we'll sing it. We'll sing it through once in unison, and we'll repeat each line. Yeah, by that time you should kind of know it. Okay, now we're going to sing it as a round, and we're going to split it up. This group will start here, then the second group will be the back half, the third group, the back half of this side, and the fourth group would be the front. Now, we're going to go through it two times, and when you're done with your section, go back to the third line, which is the mystery, okay? And then just stay on that line until I tell you to stop.
So Mark, two times through means four times with our line, right?
Right, because you repeat each line twice. Right, there's a repeat sign for those of you who read music. Right, so but we're going to go through the whole thing twice and then go back to your mystery, okay? So everybody will sing, right, everybody will sing sing all the way through two times, and then while the other people are finishing their part, just go back and sing mystery. Okay? Everybody get it? And the choir split up, so they will help you.
Paying enough attention to announcements to slip this in because I was still thinking about it, with apologies to someone who's a much better writer than I am. To green or not green, that is a question of commitment and policy. To kill or not to kill, that is a question of policy and pesticide use. To mop or not to mop, that is a question for the janitor. To paint or not to paint, that's a question of color and budget. To carpet or not to carpet, that's a question for the basement. To hang art or not to hang, that is a question of aesthetics. To volunteer or not to volunteer, that is a question for each prairie member to consider coming to the Housing and Property Committee meeting tomorrow night at 7:30. We need you all. We consider that you're all members of this committee, and we need help.
Mm-hmm. Our closing words will be read by Rosemary.
The closing words today are, not surprisingly, to life, l'chaim. Again, William James, and the end of his famous 1895 essay, Is Life Worth Living? Oops. And I quote, believe that life is worth living, and the belief will help create the fact. The scientific proof that you are right may not be clear before the day of judgment or some stage of being which that expression may symbolize. But the faithful fighters of the hour may then turn to the faint-hearted who decline to go on with words like those with which Henry IV greeted the tardy Crillon after great victory. Hail yourself, brave Crillon. We fought at Arc, and you were not there.
Thank you for coming. Please extend the hand of friendship to those around you and join us for coffee and conversation. And a meeting.